On this 21st day of December 2011 in Chicago, Illinois, we are reading from Srimad Bhagavad Gita as it is, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. We are in chapter 14, the three modes of material nature, text number 16. Some of you have books, some of you have iPods. Karmana sukatosyahu. Sattvikam nirmalam palam, rajasas tu palam dukkam, agyanam tamasak palam. Translation: the result of pious action is pure and is said to be in the mode of goodness. But action done in the mode of passion results in misery. An action performed in the mode of ignorance results in foolishness. Purport. The result of pious activities in the mode of goodness is pure. Therefore, the sages, who are free from all illusion, are situated in happiness. But activities in the mode of passion are simply miserable. Any activity for material happiness is bound to be defeated. If, for example, one wants to have a skyscraper, so much human misery has to be undergone before a big skyscraper can be built. The financier has to take much trouble to earn a mass of wealth, and those who are slaving to construct the building have to render physical toil. The miseries are there. Thus, the Bhagavad Gita says that in any activity performed under the spell of the mode of passion, there is definitely great misery. There may be a little so-called mental happiness, I have this house or this money, but this is not actual happiness. As far as the mode of ignorance is concerned, the performer is without knowledge, and therefore all his activities result in present misery, and afterwards he will go on toward animal life. Animal life is always miserable, although under the spell of the illusory energy, Maya, the animals do not understand this. Slaughtering poor animals is also due to the mode of ignorance. The animal killers do not know that in the future, the animal will have a body suitable to kill them. That is the law of nature. In human society, if one kills a man, he has to be hanged. That is the law of the state. Because of ignorance, people do not perceive that there is a complete state controlled by the Supreme Lord. Every living creature is a son of the Supreme Lord, and he does not tolerate even an ant being killed. One has to pay for it. So, indulgence in animal killing for the taste of the tongue is the grossest kind of ignorance. A human being has no need to kill animals because God has supplied so many nice things. If one indulges in meat eating anyway, it is to be understood that he is acting in ignorance and is making his future very dark. Of all kinds of animal killing, the killing of cows is most vicious, because the cow gives us all kinds of pleasure by supplying milk. Cow slaughter is an act of the grossest type of ignorance. In the Vedic literature, Rig Veda 9:46-4, the words Gogi Prinita Matsaram indicate that one who, being fully satisfied by milk, is desirous of killing the cow, is in the grossest ignorance. There is also a prayer in the Vedic literature that states, Namo Brahmanya Devaya Go Brahmana Hitaya Cha Jagad Hitaya Krishnaya Govindaya Namo Namaha. My Lord, you are the well-wisher of the cows and the Brahmins, and you are the well-wisher of the entire human society and world. Vishnu Purana 1965. The purport is that special mention is given in that prayer for the protection of the cows and the Brahmins. Brahmins are the symbol of spiritual education, and cows are the symbol of the most valuable food. These two living creatures, the Brahmins and the cows, must be given all protection. That is real advancement of civilization. In modern human society, spiritual knowledge is neglected, and cow killing is encouraged. It is to be understood, then, that human society is advancing in the wrong direction and is clearing the path to its own condemnation. A civilization which guides the citizens to become animals in their next lives is certainly not a human civilization. The present human civilization is, of course, grossly misled by the modes of passion and ignorance. It is a very dangerous age, and all nations should take care to provide the easiest process, Krishna consciousness, to save humanity from the greatest danger. Om Jnanam Timarandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Mena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master, through the prophet, opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisance to him and to all members of the Parampara. So in this chapter, Krishna is describing the modes of nature and what their effects are on us. The modes actually act within the mind. In and of itself, something in the material world cannot be said to be in a mode. It just is part of Krishna's external energy. But when coupled with the living entity and how he relates to the things in this world, these modes become active. And indeed, the whole material world is being created and prosecuted or functioning according to these modes. So here Krishna is describing different results of action in the different modes that we have. Now, the mode of goodness is not in itself spiritual per se, but it is a very important foundation upon which we can reach up to the mode of pure goodness of Krishna consciousness. Here it is said that activity, because when your mind is affected by a certain mode, then everything that you do, that you desire, is affected by that mode. You like a certain type of food, you like a certain type of music, a certain type of association, and all kinds of activities that will be in that mode. So here, in this particular verse, Krishna says that activities that are in the mode of goodness are pure and pious action. Now, what does that mean, pious? One of the things that is so important to remember is that we are social beings, and that when we act in the mode of goodness, that also affects others and tends to bring them in the mode of goodness. For instance, one of the principal qualities of someone in the mode of goodness is cleanliness, external cleanliness and also internal cleanliness. So it's easy to see how, say, in an ashram situation or just a family or in any social situation, that has such a powerful effect on others. If you make a mess and don't clean it up and someone else comes after you, then that's going to affect their mind, isn't it? And if you're, for instance, you're in a college fraternity house, you know, which is notoriously like what they call animal house, you know. Things tend to degrade, right? The laundry builds up, and then the kitchen is always unclean, isn't it? I've never lived in a fraternity house, but I understand that. The general tendency is, as soon as the boys leave their mothers, you know, they tend to let everything go, right? So what happens is that pulls everyone down, right? If you're not strong enough, if you don't fight against it, the tendency is to fall into the modes of passion and ignorance. So it's an effort to act in the mode of goodness and to stay in the mode of goodness. But you can see that so much in, say, an ashram or temple situation is based on that. Keeping the temple clean, regulation, right? The kind of words that you should speak. You know, when you walk into a temple, it's like a different linguistic world, isn't it? Outside there, anything goes. You can say anything, four-letter words, you know, but as soon as it's understood, oh, this is a different atmosphere. We wouldn't do that here, right? You see? And that affects everybody else. So pious means that you yourself tend to become more pious in the mode of goodness. You're more calm. You're more interested in philosophical matters, in the meaning of life. You're not so much interested in immediate gratification of the senses, which is more attractive to people in the mode of passion and the mode of ignorance, right? And so in that mode, if that's part of your lifestyle and you're used to being in that mode, you'll be more receptive to transcendental knowledge. Many of us who, you know, experienced in trying to spread Krishna consciousness in the West and in our own lives, I know for myself, as soon as I became a vegetarian, I became more interested in yoga and philosophical things, isn't it? And even it is said, what is that? Nivritta tarshay rupagiyamana bhavaushadat shrota manobiramat. Kottama shloka gunanavara puman bhavajeta vina pasudnat. Pasudna. Pasudna means the killer of the animals. So this is a verse spoken by Parikit Maharaj to Shukadeva at the beginning of the 10th canto, encouraging him to now it's you know hear about Krishna's Leela. And he's saying that, oh, this Krishna Katha acts like a medicine to cure the disease of birth and death, especially when it's spoken by those who are free of material desire. Nivritta tarsha ubhagiyamana. Then, bhavaushadat shrota manobiravan. It's not a bitter medicine. It's very pleasing to the ear and the mind. So who would give it up? Who would not partake of this wonderful medicine, which is very pleasing and which cures the greatest disease anyone could ever have, birth and death? Kautama shloka gunanavara puman varajeta. Who would give it up? Pashugnat. The meat eaters. We're surrounded by meat eaters. This is Chicago, right? Or the USA. Or the killer of the soul. That's another general, a more general meaning of that. But Pashugna. And why is that? Why is someone who is grossly in the modes of passion and ignorance not receptive to the message? Well, because the mind is covered. It's kind of a darkness that comes over. Like the mode of tamasa obviously means darkness, right? And these messages, the transcendental words of the Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavatam, the very lifestyle of the devotees, is a challenge, is 180 degrees different from someone who is grossly trying to enjoy. And therefore we have sattvikam nirmalam palam, the fruit is pure. One is interested in purity, he attracts purity, he's looking for purer things. Is it? And so that's good. Rajasastu palam dukam. Now this is an interesting statement. Because someone's in the mode of passion, they work very hard in order to enjoy, right? You work very hard, make a lot of money, and try to enjoy. Now, at first blush, this seems to be enjoyment. The whole world is moving on that. And at least in the short range, it seems to be a source of enjoyment. And it's said, in the beginning it seems like nectar, in the end like misery. So, when we speak about the phala, the fruit, someone who's broad-minded, you have to look in the long range. This is the famous dichotomy between shreyas and prayas. You've heard of that before? How many have heard of shreyas and prayas? It's a common phrase. Very telling. It's exactly pertinent here. Because the prayas is one who's interested in the immediate fruit. Make the money, buy something, enjoy it. You know, let me. I'm not going to think about tomorrow or the next week. The more that you just think about the immediate present, the more in the mode of ignorance you are. You know, so someone who's in the enjoying mood, rajas, you know, they don't want to think long range. You know, certainly not about life after death. You know, maybe we'll plan for the you know for maybe a few years. You know, get this degree in business, you know, then I'll go to Wall Street and make so much millions of dollars and enjoy, you know. Millions of people, young people, thousands, hundreds, anyway, had that dream until recently. Now the dream is not becoming. So, and this is the thing about activity in Rajas, is that inevitably, as Krishna says, right in the fifth chapter, yehi sang svarjaja bhoga dukha yona evate. That this sense gratification, and don't forget that the mind is also included in that, as the sixth sense, is itself the source of your misery. You know, this is a very revolutionary statement. Most people don't want to hear that, right? But sometimes it becomes obvious. When you take extreme examples, it becomes very obvious. Like the drug addict. Now, a drug addict didn't start out wanting to be a drug addict. You start out wanting to just get high and just enjoy it with your friends, right? And everyone's doing it, and so we'll do it. And the drug can be alcohol, it can be, you know, harder drugs, whatever. There's obviously some enjoyment there in the beginning. Otherwise, no one would do it, right? But then time goes by, it may not be a very long time, before that drug is your worst enemy. And even intellectually, you can understand that, but you're too much now in the thrall. You're too much in the grip of that drug. Your senses have been accustomed to it, and they're pulling you along, and you're helpless. So that's a very clear example of how activity in the of course, that's more in the mode of ignorance, but still, the enjoying principle is there. And the ultimate result is dukkham, is misery. And the ultimate misery is that you come back again, or you even lose the human form of life, right? So I like to say like this, is like, sense gratification means a little enjoyment and a lot of misery. And Krishna consciousness, a little austerity, but unlimited happiness. You know? So looking at it objectively, what's the best investment? Because really, you know, we're all investors. We're investing our time, we're investing our energy, our intellectual attention. Each day we decide where will we invest our attention and even our money and everything that we have at our disposal. So if we're wise, we'll invest in something that has a great return, isn't it? And Krishna consciousness has the greatest return. There's no question about it. Even if you consider investing your life, the rest of your life, right? As Prabhupada once said, look, you know, quote, actually relating to a Bhagavatam verse, you know, Lab Vasudulam Abhidam. So look, so many lifetimes we've had, we've invested in the enterprise of sense gratification. And when we lose the human life, we don't even do it willingly, but we're just bound up in the modes. But even all our previous human lives, which obviously didn't result in liberation, we invested so much in this enterprise of trying to enjoy the immediate senses, or a little longer, you know, attempt. But it's always void or devoid of this understanding of our ultimate shreyas, our ultimate benefit. And it comes to nothing, ultimately. We're in a part in San Diego, we're studying the part of the Bhagavatam called the Uddhava Gita in the 11th canto. We've gone through the whole 10th canto. We're almost through the 11th canto in chapter 28 out of 32, I think, 31. And it's called Jnana Yoga. Krishna's teaching Uddhava. It's the second to last chapter of the Uddhava Gita. And Krishna's emphasizing again and again and again how this material life, which we are invested in, which we are absorbed in, is just like a dream. It's just like a dream. Ultimately, it has no meaning, and it cannot at all bring you lasting happiness because it's based on illusion. And there's this one verse I'll share with you, which is repeated in the Bhagavatam 5 times. I had no idea until recently that there was a verse like that. There's one of those 5 times is a slight variation, but it's basically the same 5 times. So you know it's got to be an important verse. And it's about this subject matter, of this material life as a dream. And what he says, it appears twice in the Uddhava Gita, and Kapila Dev also speaks. He says, Arte yavidyamano pi, I just memorized it, Arte yavidyamano pi sangsritir nanavartate dhyayato vishayanasya swapne nartagamolyata. Which means this, that although this material life is ultimately false or unreal, just like a dream, still, samsriti, samsara, the suffering of this world, does not cease for one who is absorbed in the sense gratification. Dhyayato vishayan, this phrase should ring a bell from the Bhagavad Gita. If you're still meditating, even though it's a dream, you'll still suffer, just as the suffering in a nightmare doesn't cease for one who continues to dream. The swapna means dream. Now, this is a very profound statement. In other words, the meaning here is that we ourselves are perpetuating our own suffering by continuing to absorb ourselves in sense gratification, both gross and subtle. But without the alternative, we have no idea. If we're only surrounded by people who are part of our dream, and we're all sharing the same dream, how are we ever going to get out? We have no idea. That's where the intervention comes in. You know, if someone is a drug addict, they say he needs an intervention, can't get out of it, he has to be taken and put in rehab, or come on, let's go to AA. Boom. You know, let's go. Yeah, you're coming, right? He says, no, one more drink. No, you're coming. Isn't it? You need an intervention. So we have had an intervention. Srila Prabhupada is our intervention, and all the great sages and representatives, and these books in which we meet so many great souls, Bhagavatam, Shukadeva Goswami, and Prahlad Maharaj, Yamaraj. I was just reading the Hiranyakashipu Gita. Have you ever read that? Very profound. When Hiranyaksha is killed, all his wives are lamenting, and he has to pacify them. And he starts speaking like second chapter Bhagavad Gita. And then he quotes from Yamaraj, right? Yamaraj comes. So there's Yamaraj. He's also a Mahajan. You know, it's fascinating. You know, it's very, very fascinating how Yamaraj, Hiranyakashipu gives this knowledge, but then he himself loses it, you know, because of his enmity toward Vishnu. He can't follow his own instructions. And, you know, the result, he's eventually killed by Lord Nrisimhadeva. Very interesting. But the content of his talk is very, very illuminating. And the self is beyond the body and all these things. So in any case, we have association, if we are receptive to it, of all these great souls whom Srila Prabhupada has made available and his followers are now writing to. So we have the alternative. The intervention has been given to us. Now it is up to us to take advantage of that. And sometimes it's very painful waking up from that dream because we're habituated, Prabhupada conditioned. With the mind and the senses that we have, we're so habituated to acting in these modes that when we're given instruction to come out of the modes, we rebel or we balk. But that's what it means. That's what the sadhana means. Sadhana bhakti means to choose Krishna and to choose the instructions of the spiritual master over the instructions of our own mind and our own senses, which we know from experience are not making us happy. They're in the modes. And that's the result is dukkham. So if you want to give up this dukkham and actually come to sukha, we need to come up to the mode of goodness and ultimately pure goodness. And then agyanam tamasak palam. That the result of activities in the mode of ignorance is foolishness. So that means that the covering is even stronger. And you can see, if you walk out in the street, practically every city has, you know, and you see people who have kind of just, they're living on the street, they've given up, they're always like some kind of intoxication, and the dirtiness, and there's some madness, you know, then this is a very unfortunate soul. And anything they do in that condition is just going to make life more difficult until, by some great good fortune, someone actually pulls them out of that. But generally, it's very difficult when you go that far into the mode of ignorance. So these modes have to be understood. The idea behind this chapter is that we're meant to see differently. We're meant to wake up and see these modes acting, both outside and also on ourselves. And we have to choose, use our intelligence to choose, not to allow the mode of passion and ignorance to infect us, but to stay in the mode of goodness and to gradually come up to the mode of pure goodness, which is really where, you know, Krishna Bhakti begins. The mode of pure goodness is more or less like Brahma-Bhuta platform, you know, being completely equipoised in happiness and distress, not hankering for anything in this material world, not lamenting the loss of anything, and being equally disposed to all, and being fixed in devotional service. That's described in the 18th chapter, the symptoms of that. So if we really want to progress in devotional service, we should understand these modes, and like Arjuna, be very curious, how can one get out of the modes, and what are the qualities of one who is beyond the modes? And Krishna answers that at the end of this chapter. You know, the basic quality of one who is beyond the modes is that, as I mentioned, equipoise, in the dualities of this world. You know, equipoise in the, amongst the insults and the praises, amongst the heat and the cold. You know, he sees gold and stone as the same. You know? Now, how can one attain that state? Well, only by pure devotional service. Manti yoga vicharena, bhakti yoga inda sevate, sogonan samatityatam, brahma bhuyaya kalpate. That one who is unflinching in devotional service, not failing in any circumstance, transcends the modes and comes to the Brahman platform. And what's the benefit? Brahmanohi pratishtam, amitasyavyasacha, shastratasya dharmasa sukasaikantikasacha. This is our actual constitutional position, eternally, shastratasya dharmasa, and it's a position of happiness. Not sense gratification happiness, but lasting constitutional, intrinsic happiness. Prabhupada would often quote this phrase from the Vedanta Sutra, anandamayo vyasat, that Krishna is by nature full of ananda. That's the nature. And since we're part and parcel of Krishna, that is also our nature. So we should say, are we always in bliss right now? Well, no. You know? And why is that? Because we're forgetting Krishna. That's the theme of the weekend, right? Always remember Krishna. So we have lost our natural position. Prabhupada would say, I've been hearing it on tapes I've listened to, and you know, that if you're not joyful, if you're not happy in Krishna, then you're not practicing properly. You're in Maya. The natural state is to be blissful and full of ananda. So what's happened to that? You know, now we experience little flickerings of happiness in sense gratification. And some of us who are trying to be Krishna conscious, we experience it sometimes. Shikishori Kishori ki jai, Shigonatai ki jai, Jagannath Baladev Subhadraji ki jai. So, you look at the deities, they're always happy. See? They're always blissful. And they're inviting us to be that way also. So, we have that opportunity. And it comes from, you know, constant remembrance of Krishna. That's undoubtedly the basis of it. And it goes on from there to all varieties of joy in relation to Krishna, you know, rasas and everything. But the basic principle is to be conscious of Krishna always, and to be always working for his service, to always be in the mood of service of Krishna and his and the devotees, the pure devotees and all the devotees. And that really nourishes our position of constitutional happiness. We can be happy in devotional service that way. So I want to run through this purport real quick and see Srila Prabhupada approaches. Let's see. The defeat, this idea of defeat, that you cannot be successful in this material world in building a world of happiness. We see it all around us, right? Anyone who's lived in this world for any number of years knows personally and socially how this is a fact. That the material energy, the nature, always wins the battle. You know, this is those who are ignorant think that they can manipulate the material nature and for our benefit, ultimate benefit. But anything except this mode of goodness, society that is spoken of in the Bhagavatam, simple living, you see, will ultimately be defeated in this world. We can see it with the ecological crisis, right? You know, the businessmen, they look at the numbers, you know, and there's so much growth here and there's so much growth there, and it's understood, oh, growth is good, you know. But how can there be, the world is a finite system. How can there be ultimate growth, especially with all of this Ubra karma, when it depends on, you know, pulling out oil from the earth and all of these different things and so many horrible activities? Of course there's going to be a reaction. In my 22 years of living in San Diego, if you look, anyone who's been in any one spot, the weather has changed. Jai Jagannath was telling me that this is unusually warm now for Chicago at this time, right? Yeah. So, who knows? Maybe it'll be 60 degrees tomorrow. That would be unusual. Could be. But that's, you know, causes tremendous changes, you know, extreme weather patterns, hurricanes here and tornadoes going there, no water in California, too much water over here in the Philippines. It's not an accident. It's all of this ugra karma, all of this mode of passion and ignorance, activity, that they're not looking at the long range, they're not in tune with God's plan, with Krishna's recommendation for how to live in this world. And eventually it comes down, and the result is dukkham, dukkham. So personally, you know, and as a group, we need to go against that grain and live in the mode of goodness, a pure life, which actually can bring happiness and show by example how simple living can actually be a happy life. Not all of this extravagant expenditure and false, you know, technological development, which is creating a hell on earth. Okay, so Prabhupada makes that point. And then he emphasizes this meat-eating tendency. I had quite an experience coming on the flight here from San Diego. Does the name Mahasoumya ring a bell anyone? Does anyone remember Mahasoumya? He's in L.A. Yeah, he's a scholar in Gainesville now. But I remember back in L.A. in the 70s, you know, very intelligent devotee. Well, now he has a PhD in religious studies. He wrote his thesis on the Hare Krishna movement. He's a devotee, you know. So I happened to be sitting next to his sister. I didn't know that until, you know, I'm chanting, did my rounds. Finally said, "Are you chanting Hare Krishna?" I said, "Yes." And she says, "Oh, you may know my brother. His name is Michael." What is his name? Mahasoumya. Of course I know Mahasoumya. Did you ever hear of this community in northern Florida? It's called Alachua. You know, like I didn't. Of course. You know, so, but she told me about this, one of her brothers is just incensed that Mahasoumya is bringing his children up as vegetarians. He's just offended by that, you know, that they're forced to be vegetarians. And he even tried to get one of the young girls, you know, he took her in the car and tried to get her to eat a hamburger. Can you imagine? You know, I've never heard of something like that, you know. But, you know, why is that? Because it's a threat, because they feel threatened, you know, that actually this is such a horrible activity. There's no need for it. I mean, I'm a proof of that, you know. I've been a vegetarian for more than the time I've been even in the Hare Krishna movement, 40 years. I'm perfectly healthy, you know. I don't crave hamburgers, I'm not missing anything. It's horrible even to think about it. So therefore, it's not necessary. It's absolutely not necessary for health. It's simply a choice, and a horrible choice. But why is it that people can't see that? You know, medically, you know, for your health, economically, ecologically, ethically, what to speak of spiritually. There's 100 reasons under each of those headings why you shouldn't eat meat. And yet they still go on doing it. So this is the mode of ignorance. This is the mode of ignorance, covering the knowledge, simply for a flickering pleasures of the tongue, not necessary. So one has to pay for it. There's a universal government, and everything comes due. And even, you know, Prabhupada said, you're killed in the slaughterhouse, then your children will be killed in the war. We just finished a war. It was completely meaningless and unnecessary. Thousands of Americans were killed, hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, homelessness, poison the environment, spend $1 trillion which could be used. You make a list, it's completely negative. Why? Why? You know, who can explain why? Mode of ignorance, mode of passion. Okay, any questions or comments? You had something? Can you give them? It's a challenge. Yeah, it's a challenge. Thank you for that. That is true. It challenges people's views, you know, things that they've done all their life, and but it's still a very necessary part of our preaching. You know, cow protection. Prabhupada talks about cows, and the Brahmins need to be protected. Otherwise, civilization just self-destructs. Ramir, Maharaj, please. Okay, go ahead, Ramir.
So you speak about how this material life is a dream, which speaks about that in the Vedanta. But that means that the devotional service we render is also a dream?
No. We are waking up from the dream. You know, this dream analogy is really nice. There was an ongoing and still ongoing debate about, did we fall from the spiritual world or not? You know, were we there with Krishna or not? You know, so it's ongoing. I'm not going to get into all the details, but Prabhupada describes it in one letter that he wrote, which has gotten got the name of the Crow and Tal letter, and I'll explain why. It's really not a letter. It was an essay that he dictated. He uses this same analogy or illustration, and that is that the living entity, we're with Krishna right now. Now, besides from, of course, the beautiful deities. But even when the deities, we're out of the temple or the deities are closed, we're always with Krishna. But we've forgotten that. We're dreaming so many material bodies. Dreaming means that we're desiring so many things, and the material energy, according to our karma, is fulfilling those desires. Right? In a certain way. Now, there's a downside, you know, to that fulfillment. There's suffering. But still, that's part of our dream, how we can get rid of the suffering. You know, we're dreaming that. Now, the difference is that we're also sharing a dream, which you don't usually do in a dream, right? But we're also all have convinced each other that we are these bodies, right? And it all is, you know, it's blind leading the blind. But it's still a dream. And so Prabhupada says that in the spiritual world, when we somehow or other, and there's no other explanation, acquire the desire to compete with Krishna instead of serve Krishna, then we kind of fall asleep. We start dreaming these material bodies. It can go on for millions of our lifetimes and or billions of them. But when we wake up by the influence of Guru and Krishna, it'll seem like a second passed, which is practically inconceivable. Because there's no time passing in the spiritual world. You're not getting older. Your spiritual body's never getting older. You know. So when you wake up from all of these dreams that we've had, and we're back with Krishna in our original relationship, and go on, then it'll seem like, oh, that was, shoot, boy, I just nodded off for a moment. That was really a bad dream. I'm glad it's just a dream. So it's very, the spiritual activities are not a dream. The spiritual activities is part of the waking up process. Really. And these activities of being with Krishna, chanting and dancing, serving, you know, glorifying, you know, and all the other activities, this is what's going on in the spiritual world. When we refine that, and we actually are fully conscious of our personal, individual, custom-made service for Krishna, and also our form, then we're back in the spiritual world. Even if our bodies are still, you know, here. That's what it means to go back. It means to wake up from the dream.
So then we can't really choose any other condition.
No, we can choose. We can choose. As human beings, we can make a choice.
Any other condition?
Yes. The conditioning in the human form does not completely determine what choice we make. Now, it may influence, in a certain, you know, to a large degree. Like we were talking about, someone who's a gross meat eater and enjoyer, they likely won't take up Krishna consciousness, certainly not as easily as someone who's in the mode of goodness and vegetarian, because they're more receptive to it. The covering isn't as thick, you know. But you always have, in the human form of life, that's what it means. Because of the higher intelligence, you don't have to follow the urgings of the lower self. This comes up in the third chapter very distinctly, that that control the lower self by the higher self, knowing oneself not to be the body. Evam buddhi buddham buddhastam satyatma Jahishaptam Mahava. Conquer this enemy. So, you know, we're living with the enemy. Right? Krishna says the uncontrolled mind is an enemy. Right? The mind can be the friend or the enemy in the sixth chapter. So now we're in the conditions that we're living with the worst enemy. We don't even know it. You know, kama dinam katina katita palita durni deshas tesham jata mayina kodona natapano upashanti. The devotee prays, you know, I understand Madhavendrapuri actually wrote this verse. He said, my dear Lord, for so many lifetimes, these bad masters of mine, headed by lust, anger, greed, etc., they've been giving me commands and I've been carefully following them. But they don't show me any mercy. Again, I can't give them up. But now, I've now got my intelligence back. How? By association. By association with the Shastra and with the Gurus. And by that intelligence, I'm giving them up. But that's not enough. We can't just say, I'm giving it up. Then he says, I'm approaching you, O Lord. Please engage me in your service. We have to serve. One way or another. That's our choice as living entities. Whom to serve? Are we going to serve Maya? Or are we going to serve Krishna? Are we going to serve Mammon? Or are we going to serve God? And if people, and our job as spreaders of Krishna consciousness, servants of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, is to give people the choice, to let them know that there is such a choice. Now they're thinking the choice is hamburgers or meatballs. That's not a choice. You're still, you know, choosing death. But no, here's the real life. You know, Krishna consciousness. That's what preaching means. Give them that. Let them know that there is a choice. And we have to always remember that choice ourselves and make the right choice. The pure devotees are always making the right choice. And so it comes to the point where it's not even a choice anymore. It's just spontaneous. Just like right now, none of us are going to take a hammer and nail and hit it into our leg. Not one of us will do that. It's spontaneous, you know. So to the degree that we wouldn't hurt ourselves this way, we should not hurt our souls by letting our mind wander from Krishna for a moment and being always in the serving mood. That's what it means to be, you know, pure.
If our sadhana is not very strong, then we'll tend to make the wrong choices.
We'll tend to let ourselves fall under the influence of Maya. And yes, we'll make the wrong choice, and then we'll, what did I do, and then come back. You know, it's a struggle. So that sadhana practice is like a drug addict, you know, or an alcoholic. This is the structure that has been set up. Let me accept it, even though sometimes it's not what I want. It's not what I spontaneously want to do. It's austere. It's you know, not serving my senses. I'll still do it because my intelligence is strong. My will is strong. Your will is nourished by good association. That's where the intelligence is. That's why we enjoy dritam. You know, you have to be determined. Otherwise, you're right. Our conditioning is always pulling us. You know, Maya is always ready at a moment's notice or less to bewilder us again and pull us out of it. So that's where the association comes in. That's why we have these retreats where we can gather strength from others and hopefully make some advancement, get to a different platform where we're not so ready or prone to let Maya overwhelm us again. Maharaj?
I have a few things. One comment, I was just thinking what Ramita said, that you mentioned like devotional service is like waking up. And it's like sometimes in the morning when the alarm goes off, you kind of hit the snooze button.
Right.
And you roll over. Sometimes you try to get up, but you're too tired to go back down again.
Right.
That's called mental emotional service.
Yeah. It's just like that.
Yeah.
The dream, you like the dream, you want to keep the dream going.
Another thing, maybe we passed the point earlier, but I was thinking that this is a comment that I do have a question. Comment is that the preacher is preaching to the alcoholic, you know, if you keep drinking, you're going to go to hell. Oh, but my father drinks, oh, he's going to go to hell. My mother drinks, and she's going to go to hell. And my uncle, he drinks, oh, he's going to go to hell.
Right.
That seems like the theme of what you were saying. People, misery loves company, and that therefore plays down the whole idea of misery.
Yeah.
At least if you're miserable with someone else, it's not so bad.
Yeah, that's true. The thing is, for someone who's very, you know, determined to keep that curtain down, that they're not, it's very difficult to break through. It's not very difficult to break through. You know, generally, when someone is in the throes of intoxication, what can you do? You know, they're not in their right mind. I mean, Prabhupada, he confronted that when he first came to America in, you know, the 60s. If someone has lost it, I remember reading on the Bhagavatam, it was very telling. If someone loses the ability to concentrate, which is kind of a tragic thing, you know, it's said that the soul is lost then. They can't focus. It's kind of an advanced state of mental illness when you can't concentrate on anything. When you can't stop the mad mind and the nerves and the senses and everything, and you're always jumping here and there. And this society fosters that. You know, the games and the things and the drugs and this and that and just the crazy music and everything. There's kind of a collective madness, you know, never actually thinking, what does all this mean? Let me stop back. You know, stop the music, stop the madness. Where am I all heading with this? You know? I think it's changed over the years. I remember when I was a kid, there wasn't all of this stuff. And there was a large, you know, fair number of my cohorts were thinking, you know, at least what's the meaning of life? You know, we must have wasted hours, you know, sitting in the old coffee shops, you know, trying to figure it out. But at least we're asking the right question, you know. And when Prabhupada came along, you know, some of us got the right answer and we took it. So the more that one is in the throes of intoxication, either directly or you know, through habit and age, it's very hard to break through. And it's very hard to break through. It's a tragic situation. But still, there are many who are receptive. And those are the ones who we can reach. And for our own selves, we should, you know, try to wake up and stay awake. You know, stay awake more. Not let the, you know, kind of like that Madhurya Kadambani, like Vishnu Chakra would say, you know, the waves, always go in the waves, up and down, up and down, up and down. Never really coming to a firm platform.
That's one of the faults of bhakti. Yeah.
Yeah.
Question?
Go ahead.
You mentioned the 11th canto, Srimad Bhagavatam, 28th chapter.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you could explain the first two verses. That's really a mystery. I think I have an idea, but Krishna says one should not criticize one, or one should not praise. That's verse number 1 and 2.
Okay, I hadn't recalled that, but now that you mention it, yeah, that's interesting. Well, you know, that's I think that's mentioned in the, you know, it's expanded upon in the Anchalila of the Chaitanya Charitamrita. And I think it's describing, was it Ramchandra Puri, who was always criticizing. And that verse comes up. And Prabhupada mentions in the purport, it's a fault, but if you're gonna make a fault, then fault on the side of praising. You know, in other words, to always be praising devotees, that's a good thing. Even if they may not really deserve all the praise that you give them, go on that side, rather than criticize all the devotees, even if some of them do deserve some criticism. So what I get from that is that that this is a, you're talking in a material context. In other words, when you get into praising, and a perfect example is the present season in America. It always seems to be that season, but now it's getting into a real furor, political season. It's all about praise and blame. The different candidates are busy insulting each other and paying other people to praise them, right? This is what they do with all the political ads and everything. The more money you can have, you can buy someone on TV. Oh yes, a very good candidate, right? So the whole thing is that that if someone is trying to be a transcendentalist, this is a kind of duality. When you try to assess the material goods and the material bads. You know, you get hung, you get pulled into a maelstrom of that, because those who you don't, those who you criticize will then come back and criticize you, right? And it starts off that way, and it's just a huge entanglement. So I think this is a way of remaining aloof from the mundane political, you know, battles that are always going on, which is so symptomatic of Kali Yuga. And I think that's what's being mentioned. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't, you know, praise the spiritual master three times a day, like we say every morning, right? That kind of glorification is always good and is furthering of our devotional life. And we have to be very careful not to criticize, especially unjustly, you know, any devotee. So that's my understanding, my take on it.
Material praise and material blame is always wrong because it's material.
Yeah, it's all part of the dream. It's you know, it's wet stool, dry stool. It's just like that. I'm sorry, maybe you don't know that analogy. You know, so Prabhupada, this is like one of these down old Bengali analogies, you know. So you see, you know, two people arguing, very learned gentlemen arguing. You see that? That's a dry stool, dog stool there. It's much better. An arrow is as wet as a stool, you know. And the other guy has a whole argument how, no, it's not better, or it's not as much better as you say it is. And they can spend a whole day working like it. But after all, you know, it's both stool, and why spend your time absorbed in that? And, you know, you can see around the world, there's so much argument back and forth. And it's all about material things, which ultimately don't mean anything. And simply divert one's attention from what we should really be paying attention to. I mean, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he's very adamant about this point, that material education, you know, makes one more foolish if you allow it, you know. I mean, it's not that devotees can't get educated, but you have to, it's very difficult to maintain your Krishna consciousness in that atmosphere. Because one of the most alluring things for someone who has a good mind is another very sharp intellect. It's a subtle thing, you know. And if you're around people, generally speaking, devotees are a mixed bag, you know. Some of them are very intelligent. Often they're not so super intelligent. But they're all devotees. And so they're far better than the greatest mundane scholar and everything. But if you're like an intellectual and you get involved in an intellectual environment, and you very much like to hang out with these smart people, and not so much with the average devotees, because then, you know, they really are not that sharp. You're in a dangerous situation.
We lost some devotees then.
We have. And it's sad too, because these are often very intelligent devotees. You know. So that atmosphere can be dangerous. So, and all, because all of it is, you know, so many huge edifices of knowledge and books and megabytes and terabytes of information that ultimately deal with this material world, which in the final analysis is just a dream. And so this is a big thing. What is important for us to place our attention on? Where should we become absorbed? What should we really think about and learn about and learn to preach about? That's Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada has given us so much information. Yes, sir.
Since the items that are generated by the malls are temporary, if you become an expert on worldly things, whatever it may be, you're really an expert on things that are subject to decay and all of that stuff.
Exactly.
I mean, really, the three malls themselves are relatively the same.
There are gradations. It's like the mode of goodness it never appears purely in this world. It's always tinged by the mode of passion, ignorance. And so, when you say someone's in the mode of passion, he's predominantly in the mode of passion. It doesn't mean that everything, single thing that they think or do is in that mode or predominating, but that's the predominant mode. So, but the effort is, you know, is first to see it. Is to see it and see it coming, and see how, oh, if I do this, this will expose me to the mode of passion, and I'll be affected. So therefore, let me do this other thing. Let me make this effort to be clean or to come to the temple or chant more or do whatever it is, associate, cook in this way, offer my food, you know, to stay pure. It's an effort, especially in an environment where we're surrounded by people in the, you know, and things in the modes. That's the whole idea of a temple. It's meant to be like an oasis of really pure goodness, you know, where anyone who just walks in will be affected and uplifted. That's the whole idea. Even the architecture, you know. The architecture is so important. Everything is important. The pictures, the sounds, of course, the smells, of course, what we see. All the thing that's coming in is meant to uplift. But as devotees, we have a responsibility to maintain it. To maintain that atmosphere and increase it. That's how these temples are maintained and increased. And Krishna consciousness spreads. It's very important, the temples. They provide a focus. Otherwise, if all of us are just at home trying to do it, you know, it's difficult. You know, it's difficult. You need that association. Yes, ma'am.
Thanks a lot for the teacher, Prabhu. One of the things you seem to suggest we learn from this verse is when we try to stay, when we are in more of goodness, then it's easier to think about Krishna and advance in spiritual life. For some of us, it's not practical to stay entirely in more of this environment. We have to spend 8 to 5, essentially doing what Prabhupada and his condemned universe, which is work hard to build a big empire, or work hard to build a computer system, which essentially are all a lot of passion activities. And we see even advanced devotees who are involved in more of that passion activities. They were engaging in warfare. So how is it possible for someone in mode of passion to still always go to Krishna? That's a challenge. So should we just...
Well, the thing is, you have to understand that the really advanced devotees, they can engage in those activities but not really be in the modes. You know? You can still be very active. You know? But of course, it's difficult when you're associating with people in the modes, you know, and it's hard. But the ability to be immunized, if you will, you know, it comes from strong sadhana, you know, what you do with your own time, obviously, and also being enthusiastic to take part in things like where there's a retreat, where it's just pure stuff going on, you know. And really to take advantage of that. Or if you have a chance to go to India, you know, like for a month, you know, you just go to the Dham and chant and you can build it up. And then you hopefully can be better able to, push back on the modes that come in. Because it is difficult out there. There's no question about it. And all we can do is try as hard as we can and pray that we won't become affected, at least not too much, you know, or less, by those around us, and to be a positive influence. The best way to avoid the negative is just to be a positive influence on your environment as far as possible. To find those persons or those places where you can inject some Krishna consciousness and be a force for, you know, change. Because everything is fluid, you know, every day is new. And people come to work or whatever, they're in a different state. Maybe something happened in their lives, you know, which it happens in everybody's life eventually. Usually a shock, someone dies or someone gets sick or they get, you know, the notice of terminal illness or whatever it is, where suddenly, you know, their little bubble of security or whatever it is shattered. And they're open to this kind of, you know, philosophy. So it is difficult, there's no question, and that's why, you know, the best situation, of course, is to be immersed, but it's very rare, you know, to be able to do that. But we need to build our own little temples and our homes and our influence and be as determined, you know, that's why, you know, there's reading and studying regularly and to see, and to be, you know, enthused and infused with this determination that I'm not going to be swept away by this river of the modes of nature. You know, I'm going to float on that river like a lotus leaf, like Krishna says. You know? And ultimately, we can come to that point. Yes. I'm sorry. Am I ignoring some ladies over here who have questions?
Yes.
I know you have a comment.
One small experience I had was that when you're working on being diligent for about 35 years, you can either see that you're working for some boss or some company, or you can see that Krishna has sent me here and he wants me to do the best possible job I can, putting my energies, and don't see that you're just trying to please some person, but you're pleasing Krishna by that work.
Mm-hmm.
Because he says so in the Bhagavad Gita, that if I have personally given you this work, you should see like that. And
yeah.
In that way, your consciousness changes. And I personally found that you do a good job and people are very satisfied with you in this situation. And then they begin to inquire, like, what's your secret? Why haven't you always focused? I mean, where's your downtime? Let's go out and enjoy that.
This is the person you can ask about how to negotiate. In other words, your own adjustment of mind. A verse comes to mind. I don't know if I have the whole thing, but this is from the Navayogendra's teaching to King Nimi. You know, kayena mana kayena vacha manasindriyava buddhyatmanama. I forget how it goes. Sorry, but it basically he's saying it's like yet paroshi yet asnasi. That with all the activities of your mind, of your body, your service, you're actually feeling and thinking, oh, this is an offering to Narayan. I'm sorry, the Sanskrit's not with me. But let me think of this as a service to Krishna. Now, it means that okay, you have to when you have the opportunity to directly serve Krishna, you know, maybe some of the fruits of that labor, or just you know participating in the temple or doing some practice, that you actually do it. It can't just be some, because what will happen in that case, you actually will forget that after a while. But if you're really in that mood, then when the opportunity comes, or you can do some preaching just by your own consciousness there. And you can introduce somebody when you're out, you give them a little book, give them a little prasadam, invite them to the temple, or just tell them, why, no, I'm not going to go to the bar, I'm not going to the party, I have my own. Then that's, you know, that in that way you can maintain yourself, you can float above it and not get too much affected. Okay, one more from you. You still have something?
I just want Maharaj, you were saying that when you sit up there drinking out of the bottle, he's drinking out of the bottle, he said, well, my daddy is going to drink out of the bottle, so he's going to hell. I'm drinking out of the bottle, I'm definitely going to hell. My mom did, my grandmother did.
Okay, so we have a little kirtan? All glories to Srila Prabhupada.